Ego and money can get in the way. It takes the right people, the right team, and the right city. But when everything comes together, it's a blessing. Every time you go out there and take the field, you don't just represent your team or your city. You represent each other in a way that's personal. I know if I make a mistake, Cliff Avril can get hurt. And then I've got to look his wife Tia and their children in the eyes. When you reach that level of brotherhood, I truly believe that's when you win. You lose the ego and it stops being about you. It's about the people around you. People get it backward and think winning is the end goal. But when the goal is brotherhood, the winning will come and mean so much more. Your locker room isn't just a place with coworkers or people trying to make bank. You transcend the money and the accolades that come with it. You are tied to one another spiritually and physically, not just at the workplace, but outside the workplace as well. You feel their pain when they get injured. You cry with their wives. You mourn with them when members of their family pass. You work on their projects. You go to their children's birthday parties, their anniversary celebrations, and you leave this league as someone more than when you entered. Let's talk about who makes up the core of this brotherhood in Seattle. I should say that one of the reasons we're brothers is because a lot of us have chips on our shoulders. Chip doesn't even do it justice. Call it a boulder. Call it Pike's Peak. We are a team of Pro Bowlers and Super Bowl champions, but very few of us were high draft picks. We were disrespected and dismissed, and we play mad on Sunday trying to remind every team that they done messed up by passing us by. Trust me. That goes from players whose chip is obvious because they play with a mean mug all the way to the quarterback, who is the smiling face of our franchise. That's Russell Wilson. If you had never watched the NFL, and I told you our quarterback was a Pro Bowler, perennial MVP candidate, Super Bowl champion, and a college All-American who set the NCAA record for passing efficiency, you'd think he was some kind of golden child, number one draft pick, Archie Manning's other son. But Russell Wilson was a third rounder, and he was actually picked behind a punter. A punter! The main reason for that, in my opinion, is that a lot of NFL scouts just don't know their business. They are risk averse, scared of doing something different or thinking outside a very tiny box. They have a type, and if you don't fit that type, you might as well not play. Russell Wilson is 5'10", and that was enough for no one to take him seriously. Scouts have lost jobs that they would have right now if they had just picked Russell Wilson. Beyond the play, Russ is central to this brotherhood. I see Russ evolving every year. I love him because he has laid claim to his own style of leadership and his own way of looking at the world. He is so genuine that people who don't know him think he's fake, which is ironic as hell. He's himself. It's crazy that people call him phony. One thing about an NFL locker room, you know who the phonies are within 5 minutes. If Russ were screaming like Tom Brady with spit flying out of the corner of his mouth, that would be phony. Russ is himself. It's like Muhammad Ali said, "I don't have to be what you want me to be." Somehow a rumor became a big media story that defensive players were mad because Coach Carroll protects Russell Wilson and treats him differently. The whole thing was just stupid. Everybody in the world is treated differently, in some way or another. Nobody is treated exactly the same. Even when you've got kids, you don't treat every kid the same way. Also, Russ is a quarterback, and all quarterbacks are treated differently. Every team I've been on, from flag football on up, the quarterback has been treated differently. Not in a bad way. They've got a different sort of relationship with the offensive coordinator. I don't like to talk to the defensive coordinator. Just tell me the play and let me do my job. But the QB and offensive coordinator have to be closer than brothers. They have to share a brain in order to understand the vision and what the other is doing. Russ is a good friend and good people, and kids are attracted to him like he's covered in candy. My oldest daughter told me Russell Wilson was her favorite player. That was too much. I took her TV. I said, "Russell Wilson can buy you a new TV." But I do have to give Russ credit. He helped me get a table when I called a restaurant, and they were all booked up. I called them back a few minutes later and said, "Hey, this is Russell Wilson. I'll be attending your restaurant today. Do you have any tables?" And the hostess was like, yes, we can make a table for you. You were 22 for 30 the other night, 130 quarterback rating. She knew every stat. When I got to the restaurant with my wife and kids, I said, oh, thank you. I'm Russell Wilson. She was like, good joke. I said, gotcha. She took me to the table, and it was separated with a velvet rope, a makeshift VIP section. They had sparkling water and everything. My brother is also Stephen Hauschka, our former kicker. I miss Hauschka. The only NFL jersey I have in my house other than my own is Stephen Hauschka's. People think that being the place kicker is the simplest job on the team. But to me, you have to have a very special mind. The game is on your feet several times a season, and you're only as good as your last kick. Adam Vinatieri won 2 Super Bowls on the last play, but if he'd missed his final field goal with the game on the line, he'd be a bum. Hauschka is a really cool dude. I think of Hauschka and Justin Britt in very similar ways. One is a kicker, and the other is 6'6" and 320 pounds, but they are both my brothers. They have taught me that there are times when race doesn't play a part in our interpersonal relations, and we all just become spiritual. People are friends simply because they have the same moral code. They believe in the same things because they are good people, not on a shallow level, but on the level of being vulnerable, really getting to know somebody and being there for each other. My white brothers are important to everything that we do, especially in confronting racism and what divides us. I want them standing with me, as Hauschka did when he was on the team, and as Britt did on the sideline. Marshawn Lynch is my brother. He is the best running back I've ever seen. A star at Cal Berkeley, a star in Buffalo, and then a legend with the Seahawks. He retired for a year, but then came back and played on his hometown team, the Oakland Raiders. Marshawn sat for the anthem the night before I did, holding an unripe banana. The significance of the banana is known only to Marshawn. After that preseason game, people were joking that maybe he came out of retirement just so he could sit for the anthem, that he'd felt left out in 2016. Marshawn is an example of somebody people judge based on how he looks and talks, and they don't understand the depth of who he really is or what he is saying. He rocks that look because it's true to who he is, mentally and spiritually. He's as good a dude as I've ever known. He works for his community and his teammates, and whenever you call him, he answers the phone. He could be mayor of Oakland just by having his name on the ballot. I think he's a great leader, who people might misunderstand much of the time. But what's cool is that he doesn't even care. When he sat for the anthem in the 2017 preseason, a reporter said to him, "Let's talk about the elephant in the room." And Marshawn replied, "I think that elephant just left the room because a little mouse ran in here. Didn't they say elephants are scared of mouses or something? That motherfucker left, cousin." What does that mean? I have no idea. And that's kind of what makes it perfect. We also saw it before the Seahawks Super Bowl, when he said, "I'm just here so I don't get fined," to the media, over and over again. I loved that. He just stayed true to who he is. He's the only person I've ever known who didn't say anything to the media, and somehow got more commercials out of it. By saying nothing, he inspired the rest of us to speak our minds. He defies all expectations, and there are NFL fans who will never get that. But great leaders don't conform to the norms, and he defies the norms every time. Marshawn is obviously very charismatic on the field, and that's where it starts. His 2 Beastquake runs, where he ran through the entire Saints team and then the entire Cardinals team, are like nothing I've ever seen on an NFL field. His big Beastquake 2 run was the best touchdown I've ever seen. Afterward, I said he ran that like he was running to the North for freedom. We hadn't seen a run like that since the Underground Railroad. When he is really motoring, I see linebackers and safeties make business decisions to whiff on tackles instead of letting Marshawn hit them. That on-field charisma carries over to our locker room. His vibe is so intense that when he leaves a room, you feel the void. When I walk past where his locker used to be, it's like I feel his ghost. It's beautiful and creepy. but I'm not scared of ghosts, so it's cool. Richard Sherman is our shutdown corner and a future Hall of Famer, and one of the most outspoken players in the game. He's a four-time Pro Bowler who made the journey from Compton to Stanford, one of the smartest people in any room he's in. He was also a fifth-round draft pick in 2011, and has proven himself the best corner in that draft, so he's got that chip on his shoulder also. We share a lot because Richard believes he was drafted so late, because his coaches talked him down to NFL scouts for being outspoken. Richard is more cerebral than any player I've lined up with. You will never beat his mind on the field. His mind is tough to beat off the field, too. Richard has pushed me to think more deeply about what I'm doing and what I'm thinking. He has spoken out about the NCAA and about racism, and he's written essays for Sports Illustrated challenging journalists to think through their use of words like thug and posse when they write about black athletes. No doubt he has changed the language of sports journalism. Richard also gives back to the community in ways that go unreported. If I'm doing a project and working with kids, I know I can get Richard, bam, on FaceTime and see their faces light up. I talk to Sherm all the time because he's just who he is, and I love him. We also had a public debate about the Black Lives Matter movement that cemented our bond, but we'll get to that. Cam Chancellor, our strong safety, was somehow also a fifth-round draft pick and is another future Hall of Famer from our defense. He is central to why they call our secondary the Legion of Boom, because when Cam hits you, you stay hit. He has linebacker size and safety speed. When Cam was having contract issues, I did what you're not supposed to do and spoke directly on national television to Seahawks owner Paul Allen to say, pay this man. I just wanted to show Cam I had his back and that he should get his money. A lot of people have said, I can't believe you called out your owner on national television. Nobody's ever done any shit like that. But I thought, fuck it, man. Paul Allen said that he respects me for being me, so I'll just keep being me. And see how that goes. Doug Baldwin is one of the best wide receivers in the sport. He's another undrafted Pro Bowler on the Seahawks. We might have the most Pro Bowlers drafted in the fifth round or later on one team in NFL history. He's also out of Stanford, like Richard. Doug has been outspoken from the jump, addressing issues like police reform and mass incarceration and how it affects the black community. He is driven by religious principles and the social gospel to make the world a better place. Doug practices his politics differently than I do. And that's cool. He wants change, and he tries to make it happen by sitting down with politicians and police chiefs. A lot of us are wrestling with how to go from tweeting about change or giving an interview to actually seeing it happen and sustain itself. I'm trying to do it grassroots, to make change through community organizing. I don't think I'm right, and he's wrong for taking his own path. It's like the three legs on a stool. We need all of them. We need people who are outspoken in interviews. We need folks sitting across from the powerful, and we need people at the grassroots. I also have so much respect for Doug when he wrote this condemnation of the 2016 election and just put himself out there, vulnerable. Here is a portion of his essay. The fact is that we are not currently living in a democracy. The fact is that the 1% of the 1% buy politicians and write policies. They control the gathering distribution of wealth and power by distracting us with the importance of keeping up with the Kardashians. We've become a society so concerned with being individuals and looking out for oneself that we have forgotten the meaning of democracy. I know my thoughts may be concerning to some, but being on both sides of the coin has given me a great perspective. It's scary to think that we are on a path to granting the wealthiest people in the world the power to control the masses. And maybe that is why so many people were willing to vote for a president that didn't meet previous expectations for a president. The way of life of many Americans is being destroyed. Inequality is greater than it has ever been, and solidarity is nowhere to be found. The dream that America once promised has become a nightmare for a lot of people. The lack of hope and empathy has created despair and pain. Empathy and sympathy for not only your fellow American, but your fellow human has been lost. We are more concerned with status by any means. I mean, damn. Jeremy Lane is our cornerback, a sixth-round draft pick, and now one of the top corners in the league. He has taken a knee during the anthem, he has sat down, and he has turned his back facing Justin Britt and myself. Jeremy's outspokenness doesn't surprise me at all. He's a black man from East Texas. You grow up in Tyler, Texas, you know racism is real. You don't need anybody to teach you. Earl Thomas, our other future Hall of Famer safety, is the outlier. He was actually drafted in the first round. Earl was so good at the University of Texas that not even an NFL GM could mess up his selection, although there were players picked ahead of him who are now out of the league. Earl is a quiet assassin. He's quiet until you get to know him, and then he starts opening up. I texted him when I traded him my car for a Tesla. "You're still getting gas, Earl. I'm electric. I'm trying to save the world." What I love about him is that in both football and life, the man is a sponge, soaking up all the information in the room. It's been great to see him become a leader. Frank Clark is a player we need to discuss. He's a linebacker we drafted in the second round in 2015, and a very special talent. Frank came from a rough background. He grew up homeless. He has a history of violence against women, from back in college, an issue that means a great deal to me. But Frank's trying to change. He's trying to understand. He could very easily be a broken person by now. That he is not broken and continues to try to be better means, I believe, that he will stay on a trajectory to become a leader and reach kids who can't otherwise be reached. He needs to be at peace with his past, make amends, and move forward. By virtue of being on my team, he's also family, and when you are family, you help people to change and stand behind them on their journey. I don't know what pushing people away accomplishes, especially when they're young and need guidance. Frank sat with me when I sat for the anthem during our first home game of 2017. It was Cliff and I, and young Frank. It meant so much to me, not just to have his support, but also because it shows he is growing. I hope people give him the chance to show the person he's becoming. The 12s are also my family. For the uninitiated, that's the nickname of the Seattle fan base. We may not agree on every issue, but you don't agree with your family on everything. Seattle fans are some of the most famous in this sport for a reason. Their passion and their ability to hit record noise decibels when the other team's offense is on the field are without compare. I once joked that the Seahawks are so popular in Seattle that Russell Wilson got pulled over and the cop got a ticket. There are definitely some who don't mind our being political as long as we keep winning and making the playoffs every year. If we start losing, the chorus of "shut up and play" might be as deafening as the fourth quarter of a tight playoff game. But there are enough politically grounded people in Seattle who would still support us. Let's be honest. Being a fan is its own kind of thing. The ego of an athlete can quickly get it twisted. They aren't fans of you, the person. They're fans of the way you hit the QB, catch the ball, or run and jump. And that's fine. They're fans of your uniform or the city you represent. But a fan is also someone we can reach. If they hear about the work we do off the field, maybe they won't care. Or maybe they'll see the hope we can bring to a poverty-stricken area, a prison, or our hometown. And maybe they'll come out of their shell, and we can be more than just people who wear the same colors. I've seen it. The transformation of people in the 12s from being fans to feeling inspired. They start to look at you and root for you in a different way. It's a different feeling. I love the 12s, and I feel a special connection to those who are taking this journey with me. None of this brotherhood could develop without our coach, Pete Carroll, the man who gets younger every year. Coach Carroll is one of the few NFL coaches who are comfortable letting people be who they want to be. Everyone on the team also knows that when Coach Carroll was the big cheese at the University of Southern California, a private college in South Central Los Angeles, he didn't hang out in the ivory tower. He went into Compton and Crenshaw to speak with players who were dealing with gang issues and lives that were torn apart, not just to recruit them for his team, but as mentoring work. So when Pete Carroll walks into an African-American family's home and tells a player's parents, "I'm going to take care of your son," and means what he says, It builds up a lot of trust. He understands that people are individuals. A lot of coaches in the NFL and coaches in general want players to reflect their own ego. A coach who's uptight and stressed out wants his players to be as anxious and unhappy as he is. But Pete is the opposite. His open-mindedness has let people be their true selves. We have a locker room full of characters. Pete has opened up the door for them to speak their minds, and it's letting them grow into men. Pete also understands that there are some people on this team who come from difficult situations and others who do not. He doesn't see all black players as a mass. That's important because it means we trust him when he comes to us. Our brotherhood has been earned the hard way. It comes from winning the Super Bowl against Denver in 2014 and then losing against New England the next year. We have our scars, and we wear them like medals. We collaborate to inspire each other, and we support each other even when we disagree. Collaboration and solidarity are so important when you're trying to change things. This came together for us in a whole new way when Kaepernick first took that knee in August 2016. After Kaepernick made his stand, I spoke to him on the phone, along with 30 or 40 other players on the line, to discuss what we could do to offer support. People were arguing, and it was chaos. Finally, I said to everybody, "Do what you feel is right. It doesn't have to be taking a knee. It could be doing a backflip. We don't all have to agree on the idea of what we need to do, but we all have to agree on the message. The message needs to be that there are a lot of racial injustices going on in America. However you want to make a stance, be like Nike and just do it. And as long as that message goes out to everybody, it will be great." But the media focused more on who was or wasn't taking a knee than on the message. That's propaganda and the disinformation machine at its finest. In the Seahawks locker room, we did something before opening day that I bet few teams did. Pete Carroll brought us together, and we talked for hours about the issues animating Collins' move. We decided as a team to link arms before the opening game of the season, held on the explosively patriotic 15th anniversary of the 9/11 attacks. The NFL had all kinds of military tributes planned for that day. And even though Collins' protest altogether now for the 1,000th time had nothing to do with the military, it was a dicey atmosphere for planning an action. Some people criticized us for linking arms during the anthem, saying we should have done nothing but put our hands on our hearts. Other people were critical from the opposite perspective, angry that we didn't all take a knee or burn a jersey at the 50-yard line because we're the big, bad, outspoken Seahawks. But not every player is out there and political, and we agreed to do something that we could all buy into. Like I told the media afterward, I've got 3 kids, and if I ask what they want to eat for dinner, they are all going to say something different. It's hard to get people to agree on a plan, and at the end of that emotional hours-long meeting, when we all agreed to link arms, I felt like it was a big deal for us to come together, black players, white players, and connect on one gesture. We wanted to do something symbolic of bringing the community together, and that's what we did. Linking arms also was a good organizing principle. It allowed us to involve the widest layer of people on the team. Instead of just a couple of us taking a knee, we wanted to expand it. The criticisms afterward, especially from people who supported Kaepernick, were hard to hear, and in my view, they also aided the people who wanted to shut us up and shut us down. I believe that you have to meet people where they are at, and the easiest way to disable a whole bunch of folks is to turn them against each other. That didn't happen. Our goal was to plant the seeds in the locker room and in these communities where we work and are seen as role models. We also wanted to pose an all-important question to everyone, not just players. If you are concerned about these issues, what's next? What are you prepared to do? The message didn't get out there as much as I wanted, but for me, linking arms was a way to say, if we're going to talk it, we've got to live it, and the hardest thing for people to do is to live it. We want to protest. We also want to set an example as being the kind of people who take care of our families and our community. The kind of people who don't do commercials with McDonald's, poisoning kids, The kind of people who do more than tweet hashtags when a sister or brother is killed. My man Steve Hauschka was a vital voice in this meeting, telling white players that we needed to make a stand together. It took hours, and I mean hours, to talk it through as an entire locker room. People had tears in their eyes and were getting choked up while talking. It made me realize that when it's all said and done, no matter who we are and no matter what we achieve on the field, we all feel one another's pain. That's when I felt that brotherhood cement itself. And I'll tell you, it was one of the greatest feelings of my life. It was better than winning the Super Bowl. There was something about that meeting and the way we opened up to each other that I will never forget. You sit next to a person for 4 or 5 years and think you know them. Then it gets real and you say, "Wow, I never knew you felt like that. Dang, we really are brothers." I also felt I was seeing the possibility for men to evolve in this country and not to hold anything inside. It's tough to imagine a more macho atmosphere than an NFL locker room. Nobody ever wants to be emotional, unless it's getting emotional about winning the next game and kicking ass. It's easier always to be hard than to be vulnerable. But when I see teammates of mine who can knock someone into next week between the lines, shedding a tear when they talk about the world outside the NFL bubble, it really changes your mindset. Of course, we have our cliques. It's a big locker room, and you're drawn to people who think like you, dress like you, come from the same part of the country as you. It's like, "Okay, I don't know anybody here, but you're from Texas, so we got something in common." But the core that defines this team is the slowly expanding group of us that is socially minded. We understand that we are living in a defining moment. We are at a crossroads when it comes to our youth, their lives, the food they eat, the air they breathe, and the kinds of lives they are going to lead. We understand that because of technology and social media, we can play a role in shaping this future. 10 of us in a room can reach 50 million people. That's power, and we take it seriously. We also know that this is why the big sports media networks, as well as the NFL, police and scrutinize our platform so hard. They want us to be brands, not men. They want us to keep it to sports. And I get it. It's not us buying the season tickets or the luxury boxes. But at the end of the day, we're human beings. We're not just equipment. My friends on other teams, they say, "Man, what are you guys doing? You are crazy. We could never do that here." I'm talking about the best players in this league, top 10 players going to the Hall of Fame. They feel constricted, yet they are the ones with the most job security. They love that we can be ourselves. For the majority of NFL players, the only time they really act like themselves is when they're at home. They can dance and sing in the shower and shimmy with a hula hoop with Al Green playing. They see us and ask, "How is Michael Bennett saying whatever he wants to say? I want to do the same shit." But more players could be themselves if they just tried. It's like that expression, "You don't know you're chained until you try to move." If I were traded to another team, there would be no guarantee of a brotherhood. We fought for this as a team, and as long as some of us are in this locker room, it will remain a brotherhood. A political statement of a different way for a team to operate, and a break from the NFL macho shut-up-and-play code of self-destruction. This team has taught me that sports don't have to be toxic. They can be a force for good. What makes sports toxic so often is the greater society, which puts people on pedestals and lets people, from star athletes to Hollywood executives to presidents, get away with toxic behavior. The essence of sports is beautiful. People coming together to achieve a goal, regardless of their color, race, or religion. Everything about that sounds beautiful. It sounds like a healthy marriage. It sounds like commitment. It sounds like dedication. It sounds like passion. It sounds like everything worth rising out of bed for. But it gets destroyed by society, by valuing wealth over play, by professionalizing sports for our kids, which sets them against each other, even when they are on the same team. By having locker rooms where people can't be themselves. By caring about winning more than the process of how you get there. The glorification of those kinds of values is what makes sports toxic. I believe that sports has a role in changing society, from youth leagues to the pros. If nothing else, sports offers us a platform, both culturally and financially, to try to effect the kind of change that can transform entire communities and even shake up the world. Without food, your ass is going to die. Service to others is the rent you pay for your room here on Earth. Muhammad Ali. I love to eat, but I don't live to eat. I eat to live. This issue of food and what is known as food justice has been a journey for me, from growing up spending summers on a Louisiana farm, eating only healthy foods straight out of the earth that I picked with my own hands, to going through a long period where nothing I ate was healthy. Everything was processed. The quicker and greasier, the better. Then, in the NFL, I started to take nutrition seriously, and my performance on the field changed. But it was important to much more in my life than football. Eating with a healthy mindset changed my sleep, my state of mind, and even my skin. I've moved from just thinking about eating healthily to seeing food as an issue that demands activism. It didn't happen by accident. I was invited to a government forum on the problem of childhood obesity in the United States. This was a life-changing experience, although probably not in the way the organizers of this event wanted it to be. The Childhood Obesity Forum brought together people from different areas to address this pressing issue. There were political officials, nutritionists, and school superintendents on the scene, but there were also representatives from McDonald's, Coca-Cola, and Pepsi. I was sitting there listening, taking it all in, and slowly I started to get irate, like I could have taken a shit on the table, I was so mad. The people from McDonald's, Coke, and Pepsi were talking about kids as the source of the problem, as if kids were stupid for choosing to consume the company's products, the nasty crap they push kids to eat and drink. I was thinking, they are talking about me. If I were still a kid, I would be the very stereotype they are branding as the source of the problem of this national health crisis. Imagine the nerve. Here's McDonald's and Coca-Cola talking about how they want to help these kids to not be a problem. I'm thinking, you guys are the problem. How are you even here at a round table to discuss nutrition? Who the fuck let you in? I had to speak right then and there. I started chewing their asses out in that room. I said, what you guys are saying is not true. If given the opportunity and the right resources, these kids would eat right. I don't care what y'all are saying. They drink 64-ounce cups of soda because this is what they have and what you guys are pushing on them. That day, I was so damn mad. I decided to start my foundation. I went straight home to Pele and said, did you know this is going on? The fucking people sitting in a room making decisions about childhood nutrition are the ones who benefit from obesity. That's why my foundation deals with every aspect of food, from the earth to the plate. I do it because it needs to be done. I feel like I'm on a mission to share how food can be a tool for personal and community liberation with people who don't get to hear this kind of talk. People who don't learn about nutrition in school, at home, or in daily life. People who are never taught how veggies can help prevent disease, or how a balanced meal can make the difference as to whether your children can concentrate in school. Our ancestors knew what type of food to prepare when people were sick or needed comfort. They used specific foods at certain times of the year to fortify immune system defenses. We have forgotten these lessons, or they have been stamped out of our heads by processed food giants at the cost of our health and our happiness. We've got goals for our foundation. Big picture, I want to end food deserts. Not desserts, not sweets, deserts. The definition of a desert is land that is usually waterless and without vegetation. If you've ever lived in a food desert, you know what they are without my having to explain it to you. A food desert is an entire neighborhood, a place segregated by poverty and race, with nowhere to find cheap and healthy food. Food deserts are when adequate nutrition is absent in your community, and you need a car to get to a real grocery store. It's when the closest thing to fresh produce is Cheeto-dusted pork rinds. It's when food is fast food, and ordering off the McDonald's dollar menu on your corner makes more sense than $5 in bus fare and an hour in traffic just to get to a quality supermarket. It's when a liquor store with a spinning bulletproof glass cash register to pay for cigarettes and Skittles is your version of Whole Foods. When you eat that way, it doesn't just slow you down. It makes you not want to live. There are too many communities like this. And if you are not eating properly, forget about after-school programs. Forget about learning at all. Ask a room of poor kids how many have eaten fast food 5 times that week. Then ask how many in their families have colon cancer or diabetes. You'll see a room full of hands go high after both questions. More than money, more than cars, more than shoes, it's food that's the essence of everything in your body. Without food, your ass is going to die. If you don't have a goddamn piece of protein and a plate of veggies when you need some protein and veggies, that's your death sentence. It's a 21st century version of oppression. It's new, and we haven't figured out how to discuss it or break the conversation as wide open as it needs to be. Even during slavery, we may have been getting our asses beat, but we were better nourished back then because everything we ate was grown in front of us, even if it was the scraps. The soil was rich. The nutrients were plentiful. The toxic element was the slave system itself. We were brought here from the African continent, where we cooked what we grew. Now, everything we eat is processed, and it's killing us. So many kids have problems with their weight that didn't exist 50 years ago. I've seen kids 4 or 5 years old with diabetes weighing 100 pounds. I've seen kids who don't have the energy to play video games, let alone sports. The numbers are harrowing. According to the Centers for Disease Control, obesity affects 17% of all U.S. children. That's 12.7 million of our young people. Race and racism impact these numbers. Obesity affects 22% of Latino children and 19% of non-Latino black children. How did we get to this point? It's chilling when you talk to a child and they don't even know what a vegetable is. They have never seen an onion or even heard the word, and they think French fries are a fucking vegetable. One kid we were working with thought a damn strawberry was a small apple. It wasn't his fault. But I'm like, what the fuck? What school are you going to? Food is so important, and that's why I focus my foundation work on nutrition and how food creates the preconditions for a healthy body and mind. But we have so far to go. If food is self-determination, then right now, that self-determination does not exist. Athletes have a moral responsibility to step up and do something about this because we have been lying to children for years. We sell junk food to kids who look like us. We pretend we eat this shit and imply that this is how we were able to rise to the top of our sports. We say, "Hi, kids, I eat McDonald's." But Michael Jordan is not eating McDonald's. He has a chef. I guarantee that Jordan spends $1 million a year on his food, and it's not $1 million of Big Macs. We need to stop selling this poison, and we need a frontal assault on the food deserts in poor areas. The people who run Whole Foods don't want to build stores in these neighborhoods unless they are neighborhoods in transition, where poor people of color are going to be forced out anyway. They say it's not profitable to build in these communities, and they can't or won't drop their prices to make food affordable. This is why Pele and I are committed to building a network of community gardens and, once we have set them up, killing the myth that eating healthy is so expensive you couldn't do it. Food education means the world to me. Giving people the opportunity to understand how nutrition plays a decisive role in being healthy, intelligent, and able to live your best life. We say to families, "We know how tough it is out there to make a food budget work, but let us work with you. You buy 5 Happy Meals and 4 burgers. It's $27, right? Let's talk about how to go to the grocery store and shop for a $27 healthy meal. Or $15? $12? Let's talk about how we can try to make it work." But it's often a deeper problem than how to grocery shop, though. Often the parents we speak to just don't have the time to cook, or are too exhausted from work. The commute to the nearest supermarket with fresh produce is also a killer. We do cooking demonstrations and seminars to show how to make preparing food as time-effective as possible. But we know we are up against a lot of real-life obstacles as we move forward. This passion for food justice is why I've partnered with the Freedom School in Seattle. It's a summer program based on the original Freedom Schools in the South during the Civil Rights Movement. The Freedom Schools believed that literacy, history, and life are best learned through struggle, and this school is part of that tradition. At the Seattle Freedom School, kids learn about the history of struggles for justice, then they pick a project they want to focus on, and the whole summer culminates in their day of action. In 2017, they picked food justice. Their action was a march and rally culminating in speakouts in front of all the fast food restaurants near their school. They talked about nutrition, the lack of healthy food in communities of color, and the lack of a living wage for the restaurant workers. I brought the Freedom School to the Seahawks preseason camp. The kids looked at us like we were heroes. But I wanted as many of my teammates as possible to meet with these amazing young people and learn something from them. Paley and I, with our foundation, also do food justice work in youth prisons. If you go to what they call a juvenile detention center and ask a counselor who's been there for 20 years what the difference is between kids today and back when the counselor started, they'll say that it's not that youth prisoners are more dangerous or more violent now. It's that they are more tired. The word used is lethargic. They don't want to play sports. They don't want to move. It's the coming together of depression and junk food, but it's bigger than just having no energy. These kids don't want to live. If you don't eat healthily, you don't want to be alive. I've built community gardens inside these detention centers teaching kids how to garden, and you would be surprised how these young people, demonized as super predators, but too defeated on some days to get out of bed, come to life. One kid told me something I'll never forget. He said, "This project is not only teaching me what to eat, but it's showing me that I'm a human being. When I eat something that I grow, I feel like I'm not in jail anymore." Outside the prison system, when I meet kids who do eat healthily, the whole family is doing the work and taking the time to help them learn the basics of nutrition. Think about the Black Panthers. One of their central focuses was on food and breakfast programs. This wasn't just for the purpose of helping the community survive. It was to pressure the government to initiate more breakfast and lunch programs to provide healthy food to school kids. We need that pressure now, not just because the president wants to end the school breakfast programs we still have, but because the breakfasts that are currently provided are shit. Let's make real food for our kids instead of garbage on a paper plate. To hell with these Jimmy Dean sausages with French toast wrapped around them and syrup for dipping. Give our kids real food. Teach our kids the importance of eating healthily. Give our kids the chance to not be obese. The Department of Education says, "Look, these kids get a veggie, a starch, and some protein. What's the problem?" The problem is that it is all out of a damn can. You go to a wealthy private school, and the kids are online at the salad bar. It's an old joke, but at too many public schools, the only thing green to eat is the meatloaf. As much as the Department of Education spends on standardized testing, they could spend some of that money on fresh food and give these kids a chance. You go to countries like Finland or Japan, and eating to live instead of living to eat is a way of life. Food is essential to everything they do, the hub of the wheel in their lives. I was in Japan for the first time in 2016, and there food is everything. They take it as seriously as we take the NFL. In schools, lunch is a class. And that's not unique to Japan. In many places around the world, lunch is a class where kids learn how to cook, how to clean, and how to eat properly. As Michael Moore showed in his movie Where to Invade Next, when you give kids in our countries our school lunches, they start to cry. I couldn't believe that scene. The kids were actually crying, asking, "What are you trying to do to us?" Why are public school lunches so terrible? A lot of big brands are invested in school nutrition, so they give schools access to their products in order to reach those consumers at a young age. We need a return to when schools had cooks making meals fresh in the back. Make the food fatty and delicious as long as it's not processed, and as long as the plate has 5 different natural colors. That means veggies. That means fruit. That means life. Good food is the foundation not just for a healthy body, but for a ready mind. It sets the mind up for learning. And to feed the mind, we need more STEM education. Science, technology, engineering, and math, especially geared toward young girls. It's something I dream about, imagining if kids were as focused on STEM as they are on sports. Our goal is to fund and set up STEM programs all over the world for 2 reasons. First, when kids are taught these subjects correctly, hands-on teaching, experiments, kids doing physical projects, their brains light up because it speaks to their creativity. It's learning by doing. Second, STEM opens doors to economic opportunity. Before Dr. King was killed, he was exploring the question of economic justice, asking, "What's the point of being able to sit at a lunch counter if you cannot afford a cup of coffee?" This is my way of trying to carry on his work from a different angle. In this country, if you have money, people treat you like a human being. If you don't have money, they treat you like dirt. That's life. If you don't have money, it's almost impossible to eat well. If you have resources, you can eat in a way that feeds your body and mind. If young people are educated in STEM, it gives them a much greater opportunity for economic independence than throwing a football. Expertise in a STEM field means having a seat at the table of the future, because the future is technology, and if you're not helping to create that technology, from communications to space exploration to environmental management, then you're just cutting yourself off. It is crucial to be part of the creating process. For Black people, this is where our history becomes connected to economics. We need to understand our history as creators. Yes, we want you to stop calling us niggers. Yes, we want you to stop locking us up. But when I teach Black history in my kids' classes and talk to them about the inventions that Black people have contributed to our society, from the refrigerated truck to the traffic light, it shocks the students because they didn't know. If you are empowered and excited by this history, it seems more realistic that you can get a seat at the table, do it yourself, and be a part of the future. Sports is a dead end because there is no ownership potential. Playing this game has given me a platform and money to educate my kids, but STEM education gives my daughters a chance to create and own. To me, these twin issues, food justice and STEM education, are globally essential if we are going to see the next generation climb out of poverty, and I want to be a part of building that ladder. I've never thought about these issues on a global scale until I traveled to Haiti with my teammate and brother Cliff Avril. Cliff's been doing work and supporting his parents' home country for years. In 2017, I went with him, and what I saw has had a searing effect on me, like a scar I notice every time I look in a mirror. I saw pain and suffering that hurt me in a way no offensive lineman ever could. It reminded me of being young and asking my mother, "Why?" As in, why does the world even have to be like this? If you don't ask why, you'll never be attacked or criticized. No one is going to go after you or your family. But if you don't ask why, nothing, not a damn thing, is ever going to change. I think that's the difference between philanthropy and activism. Philanthropy is this kind of life-saving work. Activism is when you ask why this work needs to be done in the first place. Cliff Avril does both because he's got the soul of an activist. I grew up with an idea of Haiti as almost a fairyland for Black folks, a place founded by a victorious slave rebellion. I assumed Haiti was the Super Bowl of Black freedom, like Atlanta on steroids. I thought, before seeing it for myself, that while there would be poverty, I was going to see Black industry, Black scientists, Black teachers, and a Black world running with inspiring beauty. Instead, I saw devastation. I saw people who could have been my cousins, and with the slave trade, you never know, living in a state of torment in a country still wrecked from the 2010 earthquake. I saw destruction and disarray, but I also saw beautiful people loving each other and hustling. The pain messed up my mind. It was depressing to see so many people without access to education, clean water, or hospitals. It was also humbling to see the drive that people had to live their lives, rebuild, and not be bitter at everyone and everything. Through Cliff's guidance, I also learned something about resilience. I met kids who were walking miles just to go to school and parents working for less than a dollar a day. I worked in an orphanage in Port-au-Prince that Cliff supports, and the workers there told me about people who, with tears in their eyes, would drop kids off at the orphanages because they couldn't afford to raise them. These families would say, "If I keep this baby, they will starve. This is their only chance at survival." We got to work feeding the kids. The food was rice and some chicken. When I was feeding these kind, polite young people, I saw that they had bowls for the rice, but very few spoons. I saw them then share spoons so they could eat. But what I'll never forget is how much pride they took in what they ate. They calmly waited turns to use those spoons, even though they were starving, so they could eat with dignity. I also spoke to a woman who worked at a hospital. She told me they can only take in 6 women giving birth in a day. So if a 7th woman comes, she has to give birth outside. These were people on the edge of oblivion, but they still kept fighting. I met children who walked miles and risked drowning as they crossed a rickety bridge just to get to school. They did it not only for knowledge, but also because school was where they were going to get their one meal that day. This is a school Cliff is rebuilding, in a community called La Sharma. It's about 90 minutes from the airport, but with Haiti's lack of paved roads, it took us almost 4 hours to get there. Cliff is taking this school that looks like it could barely stand up to a stiff wind, with bedsheets hung up to create separate rooms, and turning it into a real school with 6 classrooms completely hurricane and earthquake-proofed. Seeing the kids light up at the idea that their school, and therefore their future, had a chance, led me to imagine what could happen if they had any kind of financial support. They would work their asses off and contribute to the world in ways we cannot foresee. But nobody is investing in Haiti. Maybe it's still to punish them for their revolution in 1804. Maybe if there were gold or oil under the ground, people would figure out a way to care. The Haitian people were incredibly kind to us and loved that we were there. It's not like they knew us from NFL Sunday Ticket or were Seahawks fans. I think it was more that they saw black people coming to provide aid and black people with some resources. So there was a sense of trust. They wanted to know who we were. In us, they saw hope. Haiti inspired me because its people inspired me. I saw people in conditions you can't imagine, still trying to make better lives for themselves and their families. I will never abide anybody calling Haiti a shithole. It also gave me the perspective that so much of what we think really matters doesn't. At the core of everything is survival, and it pushes you to ask questions until you get answers. Why don't people in Haiti have access to clean water? Why don't people have books? Why don't they have medicine? Why can't they have bathrooms that work? It blows your mind. It's not like Haiti is poor because it has no resources. This place was called the Jewel of the Antilles because enough wealth was extracted from its earth to enrich the entire continent of Europe. All this money was made off of Haiti. But when the people of Haiti freed themselves from France in 1804, the French charged Haiti reparations because France had lost its property. Haiti is still paying off debt to France. I wouldn't pay them anything. What are you going to take? You took everything. There ain't nothing left. There's trash everywhere. There are still crushed buildings every place you look. There are people who still don't know if their loved ones died in the earthquake, and it was 8 years ago. It's easy to question the whole human experiment when you see Haiti. But the trip also left me thinking about my friend Cliff, and I was like, damn, what he's doing is so much bigger than anything I've thought about. A lot of players in the NFL do foundation work. Some are passionate about it. For others, it's just PR or a tax shelter. But either way, whatever the work we do, how much of an impact are we making? Are we saving lives? Having seen a lot of poverty in the United States, I'd say that the difference between here and Haiti is that the opportunity for a better life in Haiti seems so much more narrow. But there are parts of the United States where conditions are similar. We just choose not to see them. Last year, I went to South Dakota to run a football and health clinic for the Lakota Sioux tribe. As in Haiti, I saw poverty, pain, and an absence of investment. But also as in Haiti, I saw resilience, a culture of family, and a deep belief in the power of spirituality. It's humbling to see that kind of resilience and spirit alongside the loss they have suffered and continue to suffer. The past isn't past for the Sioux. The people I was with are 50 minutes away from any access to fresh food. They live on the Badlands, which is literally bad land, land that can barely grow crops. These people have an incredibly close relationship with the earth, yet their lives are built around processed foods. I saw dangerously overweight kids. It was impossible to avoid the contrast. Poverty and malnutrition in Haiti mean starvation, while poverty and malnutrition here mean early onset diabetes and obesity. It's also near impossible for them to find banks to deposit their money. They are isolated from every potential lifeline to hope. But their fighting spirit remains. The Sioux spoke to me about the confidence they feel from the fight against the Dakota Access Pipeline at Standing Rock. It was a movement to keep their earth unpolluted, and they faced down tanks and tear gas to do it. Win or lose that fight, the confidence they gained from waging it isn't going away anytime soon. I see all this pain and strength in the face of it, and I wrestle with how to increase my philanthropy and also build the bridge I described between philanthropy and activism. I've announced that every endorsement I get will now go to charity, specifically channeled into underserved communities of color. I didn't go public with this for extra attention. I wanted to spotlight it as a way to encourage the companies that want me to endorse their products to match what I'm doing. This has been far more difficult to accomplish than I thought it would be. I've sat across the table from company reps to talk about improving what they give back, and they look at me like they're malfunctioning robots saying, "Does not compute." It has shown me that even companies that talk a good game aren't really invested in communities. Too many will do just enough for public relations and then shut the door. The only difference between them and Enron is smarter accountants. The goal is to pressure companies to make them accountable for how they operate and how they profit in our communities. You look at some of the grocery stores and businesses in black neighborhoods. You look at what Chris Rock calls the black mall and compare it to the white mall, and you see the gap. As Rock says, there ain't nothing in the black mall. Nothing in the black mall but sneakers and baby clothes. Much of that is because a lot of white communities have a business association to invest in their neighborhoods, parks, and infrastructure. Look at a suburban kids football team, and that team has 10 logos all over the uniforms. When you look at black communities, it's different. All the screaming faces on cable news were so critical of the people in Ferguson for tearing down their community, when in reality, it's not truly their community because most of the businesses aren't community-owned. And the businesses that are there don't give back. They are taking money out of the community. They're extracting the wealth. Little different from the situation in Haiti. It's the private business version of the police writing up excessive parking tickets in Ferguson. As athletes, we have a tremendous untapped power to hold accountable the Fortune 500 companies that sign us to endorsements. Instead of our signing nine-figure deals with Nike, imagine if we started from the point that Nike owes our community money. A $200 million trust aimed at, to use just one example, eliminating food deserts in the United States, and then we work with them on administering it. If athletes came together to demand these kinds of investments in exchange for our sponsorship, it would make all the difference in the world. I think about the number of community gardens that could be thriving with that kind of investment. The problem is that we might be the face of Nike or Adidas, but we exert no say and we don't try to exert any say in the direction of the company beyond what colors or designs we want on our products. We are just an extension of the Nike brand. That's why it makes me so uncomfortable when people on the business and accounting side of my life ask,